Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
The good news is that most areas of the West have had another good winter season for snowpack and precipitation.
That's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
If you look at the entire 11-state western region, there's only parts or all of four states that are really struggling in terms of snowpack. Those four, Washington and Montana, along with northern sections of Idaho and Wyoming, have come up a little bit short on precipitation and snowpack this winter. And snowpack at this time in some of our driest basins running broadly less than 70% of average for the end of February. That portends that we'll have below average runoff in those areas. And so in states like Washington, where reservoir storage is already below average, we will likely see some water supply issues as we move through the spring and summer of 2024.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We just finished the best 3 years of net farm cash income in the history of the United States.
Testifying recently before the Senate Ag Committee, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack.
On the other hand, as Senator Bozeman has just indicated, we are now returning to near historical norms this year in terms of farm income. It's a combination of input costs as well as lower commodity prices, which are a result of bumper crops globally, a strong U.S. economy and a strong U.S. dollar, a weaker global economy, and certainly a weaker Chinese economy, all of which impact and affect our ability. It's interesting that the farm income is not equitably divided among all farmers. The top 7% of our farmers, who are represent roughly 150,000 farms, about a third of which are owned by investors, received 85% of the income over the last 5 years, which meant that 93% or 1.7 million farm families had to share 15% of the income. At the same time, the median farm income for the families was significantly higher than median farm family income across the United States. 88%, however, of farm families work off the farm. And in fact, a majority of the income utilized by those families is generated from off-farm income. Our farm story here in the United States has been one of tremendous productivity. In the 1970s, we established a directive to farmers to produce. We were told farmers were to plant fence row to fence row, and farmers responded. We've seen a fourfold increase in productivity over the course of the last 50 or 60 years. But at the same time, we saw a corresponding consolidation of farmland and farm loss. Madam Chair, to put this in proper perspective, we've lost 544,970 farms since 1981, when Bob Berglund, then Secretary of Agriculture, warned about consolidation of farms. We've lost 155 million acres of farmland that was at one time farmed that is no longer being farmed today. To give you a sense of how many farms that is, that represents roughly half of all the farms represented by this committee. Today, the farmland represents the entire land mass of Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, Maryland, and a good part of Virginia. This has had a long-term impact on rural communities, and we've seen over the course of time reduced job growth, high unemployment, and high poverty. However, recently, we've seen an upturn in the rural economy. Jobs have now returned to pre-pandemic levels. The unemployment rate is down to historic lows. The poverty rate is down. And for the first time in quite some time, persistent poverty is down. In fact, 55 counties that were characterized as persistently poor have left that list. Those are counties that in the past had had a poverty rate of over 20% for decades. We've now seen a net decline in the number of counties in that persistently poverty category. I think it raises a question that we ask at USDA, and I suspect you do too. Are we okay with farm loss? Are we okay with farmland being consolidated? Are we okay with income being so concentrated? Are we okay with the notion, as has been expressed in the past, about getting bigger, getting out as being the only option for farm families? Or is there an alternative? An alternative where, rather than the farmer working two jobs, can't we create opportunities that the farm itself creates multiple sources of revenue so that the farmer doesn't have to work two full-time jobs to keep the farm? That's why we're focused at USDA on more new and better markets, on climate-smart agriculture, on renewable energy, on local and regional food systems, as creating an opportunity for new and additional income sources to provide opportunities for farmers to do what they love to do and to do what they want to do, which is to pass that opportunity on to the next generation.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We've fallen far enough. The prices that we'd be insuring would be down near some of the crop insurance insured levels, like for PLC, et cetera.
Dr. Dan O'Brien is a Kansas State grain marketing economist. He's got some marketing thoughts as we trend lower with commodity prices.
For instance, for corn, these corn closed yesterday 463. You look at a 460 put option for about 35 cents. Well, 460 minus the 35 you'd have to pay, you're down to about 425. And that's below the ARC price now for corn. And I think the PLC price is 401. So we've dropped far enough now on the futures sets of contracts, particularly for Dease corn, where if we did go in and buy put options, our price insurance is not that far above even PLC. And I'd say for wheat, again, we closed yesterday for July wheat at 574, 570 put options, 34 cents, so 570 minus 34, you're about 535. You deal with the broker, you're 534, something like that. And that's just at the futures. And again, we're not far from I believe wheat's 550. So that's a real issue for people to wrestle with. Now we're low enough for if we have bushels that aren't farm program related, if we want more upfront control of our coverage, we could go in there and give ourselves some price protection. But we're low enough now to where it compares to some of what the farm program offers. I'd say just quickly then for soybeans, November soybeans closed 11.33 yesterday at about 11.20 is the closest option, 11.20 minus about a 63 cent put option that give you price insurance at about 10.60, something like that. And I think that's still sharply above the like 8.90 thereabouts, $8.90, $9 for what you'd have for the PLC contract. So if anything, probably the price coverage and risk management opportunities for soybeans are probably more attractive than the others, because the others are already kind of mired down pretty close to where the other farm program price protections are.
Of course, one driver for market prices is export demand. What's he see on that front?
A lot of dynamics. Perhaps part of what also has given some strength to prices is that we've gotten low enough apparently now where world buyers have been able to come in. I didn't say sneak in, come in and to buy a fair amount of grain at a pretty cheap price compared to where we're at. And that for corn, we had average about 47, 48 million bushels here in for the week ending February 22nd, need about 50 to meet the USDA average. And really, that's pretty good compared to where we had been. Grain sorghum, about 4.95 million bushels of the week ending the 22nd. We need about 4.1 to meet the USDA's projection. So going great guns there. We get into the wheat complex. Hard red still languishing, but soft red going wild. Really had a week of 10.3 million bushels of hard red spring being exported. Need about 4.75 million bushels to meet their USDA goal, as opposed to where we're at on hard red. Again, just tough Russian, Ukrainian, Black Sea competition for that type of wheat. 1.2 million bushels exported, need about 4 to meet the USDA's projection. So tough there. And soybeans, we exported about 40.5 million bushels for this most recent week. We have numbers for, need about 20 to meet the USDA's goal. And what window do we have relative to South American availability? That's really the issue. But while we've got this opportunity, we're exporting some soybeans, so that's a good thing.
Kansas State grain marketing economist Dan O'Brien. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Overall, cash was stronger last week.
Lee Schultz is an Iowa State livestock marketing economist. Looks at cash trade in the cattle market.
When you look by region, roughly $1 to $2 higher. You know, I think it generally points to a rather bullish market. You know, when you pair that with futures, you really had to look at futures for most of last week was kind of coming back, and we've seen an overall negative week. But then Friday really hit, and Friday we've seen much higher futures prices, which I think were kind of a reflection of the stronger cash trade for the week. And so, you know, overall, I think you point to the week being steady on average, but again, realizing there was a lot of volatility in that futures market. You know, some of that I think is maybe coming off of what maybe was a bit of a bearish cattle on feed report, if you had to point to anything. But, you know, I think the fundamentals really remain rather strong and point to higher prices overall. You know, I have to focus a little bit on the feeder cattle market. For feeder cattle, we've seen receipts rather large, which may be surprising to some as you think about the tightness of cattle supplies. If I look back at the National Stocker report that USDA puts out, this would be for the week ending February 23rd. So we got to go back a little bit just on how the data is released. We've seen receipts where we're up about 25% compared to the week prior and almost 50% higher than a year ago. I think that's more of a reflection of the demand necessarily, as much as the supply. So, you know, as you think about the fall months are looking really attractive for feeder cattle. And so I think that's really providing a lot of strong demand there, and very, very attractive sales. And then when you think about, I think producers now, as we're getting into calving season, I think moving out the old crop of feeders and getting the calves in, I think that's provided some attractiveness to sell those feeder cattle. So, you know, I think the feeder cattle market still remains relatively bullish and really, you know, even with the larger receipts that we've seen.
One question that's been circulating is whether or not the wildfires in Texas could impact prices.
I think we have to really send our prayers as we think about the fires in Texas and the impact on you know, operations and livelihoods there. Certainly devastating to the folks in the Texas Panhandle. The numbers I've been seeing is, you know, over 1 million acres have burned. And really, it's just guesstimates and preliminary of really the destruction that's occurred to these operations and the impact of animals, the impact of relocating animals. And I think we need to also think there's broader ramifications here. You know, as we think about it, you know, I've heard as far as, you know, impacts on rail, because there's had to be some railroads, some of the tracks closed or inspected. So if that's impacting the supply or transportation of feed. And so, you know, while the impact is large, over 1 million acres, you know, it could be much larger in effect when we think about just all the ramifications. And so, you know, and then you also think about impact on cull cow values. You know, that is a market where, you know, nearby there is some cull cow slaughtering. We know there's a fair amount of cows there. And so impacts there, I mean, we will eventually be able to know the larger impacts. You know, something that's not going to move the whole aggregate market, but certainly on that particular area, devastating for the producers there.
Iowa State livestock economist Lee Schultz. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
USDA has estimated thrifty food reevaluation increased NAP costs by nearly $20 billion in 2022 alone.
At a recent Senate Ag Committee hearing, the ranking member, John Bozeman from Arkansas, and Secretary of Ag, Tom Vilsack.
Has USDA determined the total cost of the 2021 Thrifty Food Plan reevaluation across all nutrition programs, such as the Emergency Food Assistance Program, TFAP, and others whose costs are based on the TFP?
You know, Senator, I'm not sure that we've made that calculation. I'd be more than happy to ask our staff to look at it. Having said that, you know, I think what we did was justified and appropriate, because the whole point of the SNAP program is to provide help and assistance to families based on the reality of what they live in. What we had not done in SNAP, which we did do a couple of years ago, was to actually ask the question, how much does it actually cost at the grocery store, and what, in fact, are people buying? Not assuming what they're buying, but what, in fact, are they buying? And from that, we obviously calculated an increase, which for families meant an opportunity to avoid some very serious consequences, especially when the emergency allotments were lifted off. But I'm more than happy to take a look at this, and happy to take into consideration anything else that you want us to consider. At the end of the day, you know, there are many ways in which we can look at the SAP program, but one thing is that we're seeing fewer people using it today, so the expectation is the cost is going to come down a little bit.
The GAO made 8 recommendations to the Department for future TFP reevaluations, and USDA has only implemented four of those recommendations. Could the next TFP reevaluation begin before USDA has closed out the remaining recommendations made by GAO?
We've made a concerted effort to work with GAO to close audits and reports, Senator, so I'm certain that we will do this on a timely way. If you talk to GAO, you'll find that we've been very, very cooperative, much more so than previous administrations.
So when do you think you'll get the four done?
I don't have a specific timeline for you today, Senator, but I'll be happy to get it for you. I'm sure it will be before we have to reevaluate the Thrifty Food Plan.
So you could reevaluate it without doing it, though. Is that what you're saying? Or?
No. What I'm saying is that we will take the actions that GAO has requested prior to any reevaluation of the Thrifty Food Plan, because we are focused on making sure that we work collaboratively with GAO on recommendations and audits, as we do also with OIG.
Good. In May of last year, USDA issued the initial study plan for the 2026 TFP reevaluation. My understanding is USDA is awaiting additional data to inform this reevaluation, such as scanner data on food prices and the recommended 2025 dietary guidelines for Americans. Do you have any insight on how this information will impact the cost of the TFP to taxpayers, and when you do expect USDA will begin the process for the 2026 reevaluation of the TFP?
Well, obviously, we don't know because we don't have the information, but I think it is appropriate for us to ask for this information. It gets back to the point that I made earlier, which is we have to deal with what actually is happening in the marketplace in terms of actual costs, and we also have to have a better understanding of what families actually use and need. I can go into great detail about the way this was done before in terms of the assumptions about families that were struggling financially, but they were not lined up to the reality of families. The amount of time preparing food from scratch, the amount of beans and other items that were purchased that just are not aligned with everyday American life today. So it's important for us to have that information to be able to make an informed set of decisions.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
U.S. exports in 2023-24. Are forecast to be 15% higher than 14-15.
Jake Villeman is an analyst with USDA.
This is 15%, sorry, 20, U.S. exports in 23-24 are forecast 15% higher than they were in trade year 14-15. But this is still within the historical range. As prices come down in 24-25 and economic growth hums along, the pie for global corn trade is expected to get bigger, and this should support a bigger U.S. export number. However, with Brazil's success in China lately, and Brazil and Argentina also performing well in Vietnam, the competitive environment will be very challenging for the U.S. And as we've seen in recent months, Mexico will continue to be incredibly important.
Speaking at USDA's recent Ag Outlook Forum takes a look at the soybean balance sheet.
U.S. soybean production is forecast at a record 4.5 billion bushels in 24-25, 8% higher than the current crop year. Expanded area and a weather-adjusted trend yield of 52 bushels per acre drive this projection. With current estimates for carry-in, total soybean supplies in 24-25 will be the second highest on record after the 18-19 crop year. Again, normal weather for planting and crop development is a key assumption underpinning this outlook. With supplies anticipated to increase year over year, the outlook at this point is for continued growth in soybean crush, some recovery in exports, and a higher carryout to end 24-25. Exports are projected to rebound 9% to 1.9 billion bushels on global demand growth. Crush is expected to total 2.4 billion bushels, up 4% from the current crop year and reaching a record for the fourth consecutive year as domestic biofuel programs support demand. This means crush is again expected to be the leading use of domestic soybeans. In the past 5 years, crush has outpaced exports 4 out of 5 times. In the 5 crop years immediately preceding this, crush only outpaced exports 2 out of 5 crop years. Another factor behind the larger share of soybeans growing to crush has, of course, been competition with South American supplies in global markets. Another big part of the story that I alluded to earlier behind the record crush in the out year will be continued growth in demand for biofuels, driven by a growing federal mandate and by state programs. This chart shows California's diesel pool over the past few years, with a breakout for renewable diesel, biodiesel, and diesel. The red dotted line, which corresponds to the right axis, plots the share of California's diesel pool that comes from biofuels. As you can see, the share of renewable diesel and biodiesel surged beginning in 2021, and in the first three quarters of 2023, made up 60% of the total pool. It's no coincidence that several consecutive years of record soybean crush correspond to the surge in the share of biofuel in California's diesel pool. With domestic biofuel programs supporting demand for soybean oil, its share of crush value, shown by the green line and the right axis on this graph, has entered a new plane. In the first 6 years plotted here, soybean oil's share of crush value hovered between 30 and 35%. However, in recent years, its share has been between 40 and 45%. With soybean oil carrying more of the crush value than in the past, record soybean meal production has found an outlet in the export market. The blue bars and the left axis of this graph correspond to soybean meal exports, which have achieved record levels the past 2 years and are expected to set another record in 24-25. This is the case even with a normal crop in Argentina because of their export taxes on soybean meal, global demand growth motivated by lower feed prices, and the support that the U.S. biofuel programs give to crush and soybean meal production.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Fox beef trade is, I wouldn't call it maybe contra seasonal quite yet, but we've seen very strong box beef values here as you look at the last couple of weeks.
Lee Schultz is an Iowa State livestock economist.
Really, this last week, you know, we were up about $5 on average for the week in the choice box beef. Part of it you have to point to the slaughter level. So it's been 2 weeks now. We've been under 600,000 head for slaughter levels, and I think that's really helped support those box beef values.
And though our focus is mostly on cattle, he also looks at sheep inventories.
This is an article I had a lot of fun with, talking about our cattle inventory cycles, because it's certainly a very germane topic right now as we're really entering or continued to in the downturn of the cattle inventory cycle. And similarly, we're in the downturn of the sheep inventory cycle. And these cycles are roughly 9 to 14 years in length. You may think, well, the sheep inventory cycle would be shorter in length because, one, gestation is much shorter, also possibles for twinning, and they're just, for birth to market, it's a lot shorter time period. But overall, the cycles are very similar for sheep and cattle. I think the biggest thing is weather, really, a lot of times dictates what those inventory cycles look like and changes in those inventory cycles. And a lot of the same factors are impacted for both cattle as well as sheep. You know, one other interesting note, our sheep inventory is the tightest that it's ever been since USDA began releasing the data. You have to go back all the way back to 1867. We have the smallest sheep inventory here in the United States ever since they started collecting this data. So while we've seen cycles over time, the inventory has certainly decreased over time. You know, and when you look at cattle inventories, we're the smallest since 1951 when you look at all cattle and calves. It's very difficult to time the cattle cycle, right? And so, you know, you would obviously like to have your highest inventory when cattle inventories were the smallest nationally because prices are typically the highest. But there's a reason why inventories are tight and prices are high at those times. So I think one thing to keep in mind as far as understanding of the cattle cycle is we are in a time of the cattle cycle where we're going to see some really strong prices the next couple of years. And so the key now is to make investments that are going to make you much more efficient, not only now, but into the future when we know cattle prices will eventually start to decline and profits also start to decline. So it sets you up for a much better when we're seeing much tougher economic times. You know, a lot of times the best decisions are made not when times are tough, but when times are good, because you're setting yourself up for potentially when those conditions become much more difficult for producers. Again, part of the fun of the article is when you look at cattle and sheep prices and feeder cattle and feeder sheep prices or feeder lamb prices, actually their annual average for the last about 20 years is about the same, right? So you may think, well, you know, we're obviously selling more pounds when it comes to feeder cattle than for feeder lambs. But also when you chart those prices over time, it's interesting that when you have high feeder cattle prices, you usually have a bit lower feeder lamb prices and vice versa. So there, you know, there is strategies for diversifying would allow you to, you know, benefit when cattle prices are lower from higher sheep prices. Now, that's potentially easier said than done, because really you got to have enough inventory in either sheep or cattle to benefit when you have those higher prices. And a lot of times, again, it's hard to time these inventory changes as well as these price changes.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Representatives from 16 U.S. food and farm organizations and companies and members of a couple of state agriculture departments are on their way back home now after spending the week as part of
the first ever trade mission to Angola.
The leader of that mission, Deputy U.S. Agriculture Secretary Sochil Torres-Small, says it was planned to give farm and food companies a chance to just sound out the Angolan market, explore the prospects for future trade with this southwestern African nation.
But they actually ended up leaving with sales. We resulted in over 120 business-to-business meetings, and currently they're reporting over $18 million in projected 12-month sales. That's a big number. In fact, it's the highest we've had in Africa for an agribusiness trade mission ever.
She says it goes to show
the opportunity that exists in Angola and across sub-Saharan Africa.
Countries with a growing middle class. Gary Crawford, Washington.